My family rarely watched first-run TV shows. That is, that when episodes of television were first showed on networks, we rarely watched them. I don't know why that was, probably because my parents had some aversion to us watching a lot of TV, or they wanted to censor that which we watched. But as we grew older, we watched syndicated reruns. And one of my favorites was the show MacGyver. I loved that show because the title character used intelligence rather than the mindless violence of guns. In fact, he rarely ever used them, unless I think on one episode he used one as a wrench. The quintessential Mac description appeared in the pilot episode where one character asked him, "Don't tell me you know how to make a bomb out of a stick of chewing gum," to which he responded, "Why, do you have some?" He used common items to do amazing things, some of which violated the laws of nature. For instance, once he used an electronic flash on a camera to detonate C4. And for those of you who have any knowledge of C4, you need a blasting cap for that. The advertisements for the show, at least when it was in syndicated reruns, were, "MacGyver, what's he doing with that thing?" And it summarized the allure of the show. What is he doing with that bicycle? Well, he's making a blowtorch. What is he doing with a battery and a couple of 50-cent pieces? Well, he's making a welder. You never knew what he would do with common items. In fact, that welding idea my brother actually used once, it actually works, sort of. And here we confront a similar series of questions. What are these people doing? It's a basic study technique when reading the Bible to ask questions of the text. And here the questions just leap up at you. What are these people doing? What are these characters? What is motivating their seemingly uncharacteristic behavior? In the passage before us, there are three characters that take center stage, that are the main actors. And then we are going to look at them individually: Reuben, Jacob, and Joseph. These three actors are really driving the narrative here in this first chapter, in this extended story of Joseph's interaction with his family. And we're going to look at them in order from the least to the greatest. What is Reuben doing? What is Jacob doing? And finally, what is Joseph doing? What is Reuben doing? In order to understand Reuben's part in the story, we must remember who he is in his history that we have already seen. Reuben is the firstborn of Jacob, born to Leah, born to the wife that Jacob did not prefer. We know that he was out picking mandrakes. Don't know exactly what those are, but he was giving them to his mother, who used them for illicit purposes. We know that he also committed incest with his father's concubine, and that sin lost him favor in the eyes of his father. His position as the firstborn, the leader of the family to come, suffered a major blow by his sin. We know that when the brothers were planning the demise of Joseph, he stepped in and said, "You know, let's not kill him outright. Let's throw him into a pit." And then we are told, as an aside, that he intended afterwards to rescue him from the pit and return him to his father. But that rescue attempt failed. As a leader, he is a bit of a disaster. And that theme of his disastrous leadership continues as he speaks to his brothers and to his father. To summarize this story, as the brothers go down to Egypt, everything goes wrong. The vizier, the governor, accuses them of spying. Now, to understand this accusation, it's not all that suspect that you would have these 10 brothers apparently coming down, and you have 10 brothers from 3 different mothers, and they're saying that they're coming down to buy grain. Now, that story strains a little bit of credulity. And so he accuses them of spying and throws them in prison for 3 days and tells them that he's going to hold one of them hostage until they return with their youngest brother. He said, "You're telling me this story that your 12 brothers, one's dead and the other is left at home. Well, we're going to test that story. You bring your youngest brother here, and we'll see what happens. And until you bring your youngest brother here, this guy is going to stay here in the prison. All of this happens to them. They agree to the deal. What other option do they have? They say, sure, we'll do that. Because the first idea was that one brother went back home and the other nine stayed in the prison. And so nine going home and one staying in the prison is better than the first alternative. So they agree to that. And after agreeing to that deal, they reach the conclusion that this is justifiably brought about them. At verse 21, they said one to another, We are verily guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. They go back to Joseph and they say, we deserve what we're getting. There's a bit of karmic notion here that what they have done to Joseph is coming back on them. And why do I say it's karmic? Because God is not mentioned here. They have some notion that they deserve what's happening to them, but there's no distinct statement that God is bringing it upon them as a type of divine justice. God seems conspicuously absent in their calculations up to this point. And while the brothers experience the pricking of their consciences, Reuben takes an opportunity to play a little bit of a blame game in verse 22. Reuben answered them, saying, Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, his blood, also his blood is required. Reuben says, I told you so. You guys wouldn't listen when I told you to leave Joseph alone. And now we're all suffering. Reuben is not exhibiting good leadership. He would have known as an experienced leader that the buck stops with him. As the firstborn, whatever happened to Joseph was on him. He should have known that. He was the leader of the brothers. He could have said to the other nine, leave Joseph alone. We're not going to kill him. We're not going to throw him into a pit. We're going to welcome him as our brother, and I will protect him. Instead, he came up with this rather fantastic notion that he would convince them to throw him in the pit, rescue him later, and surreptitiously sneak him off to Dad. And I suggested earlier that Reuben wanted to rescue Joseph maybe in order to place himself back into his father's good graces, to differentiate himself from the rest of the family, like these nine guys, they wanted to kill your favorite, but I snuck him out. Perhaps what is making Reuben say these things is frustration that his plans did not turn out the way he thought. But notice also the lack of logic in this statement. If he was actually innocent from the blood of his brother, why is he suffering with his brothers who were more guilty than he? If Reuben didn't consent to their evil, why should he share in their punishment? But he does. Not only does the ineptitude of Reuben's leadership appear when he talks to his brothers, but also as he talks to his father. After their return, the brothers tell Jacob what happened, and Jacob assumes that Joseph and Simeon are dead, or, as far as he knows, as good as dead. Now the brothers want to take away Benjamin. In verse 36, and Jacob their father said unto them, me ye have bereaved of my children, Joseph is not, Simeon is not, and ye will take away Benjamin. Like every time you guys go off on your own, something bad happens. You went off on your own and Joseph died. You went off on your own and Simeon is as good as dead. And now you want to go off on your own again and you want to take the only son that is left to me. And Reuben wants to rescue his brother, and so he tries to give some assurance to his father in verse 37. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. This is what Reuben is saying. Dad, take my two sons and kill them if I don't bring Benjamin back. Let me take Benjamin down and rescue Simeon, and if I don't bring him back, I will bring him back, but if I don't, you can kill my two sons. Let's think about that. Basically, what Reuben is saying is, let me take your son, and if your son passes away on the trip, kill two of your grandchildren. I'm not sure that there's any calculation in which that actually works as a comforting alternative. Because if the worst came to the worst and Benjamin did die, then not only would Jacob lose Benjamin, but also two grandchildren. I'm not sure that really works. How is it that you can imagine that that's going to be a viable comfort to a father and a grandfather? Reuben gives us an example of horrible leadership. Leaders must accept the fact that the buck stops with them. They are responsible for the behavior of the group, whether that group is a family, a business, a political subdivision. The leader is responsible for those he leaves. This biblical principle appears in Hebrews 13, verse 17, when the author of Hebrews tells to the congregation, "Obey them that have the rule over you, and submit yourselves, for they watch for your soul as they that must give an account." The author of Hebrews says, "Obey your elders, because they're the ones that have to answer to God for what it is that you're doing. That you do it with joy, not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you." This is something that we all must remember, because most of us at some point in our life will be in some position of leadership, whether it's parents to children, employer to employee. We are all going to exist at some point in a measure of leadership. And the biblical principle is that leaders give an account for what goes on. But Reuben shows bad leadership in the inducement he offers. His solution to the problem of redeeming Simeon was to sacrifice his two sons. We need a better leader than Reuben. We need a better solution to our redemption problem than his two sons. We need a leader who does not sacrifice sons but himself to redeem a people that he is not ashamed to call brethren. Yes, it is the gospel according to Genesis, for here in this notion of sacrifice, we see this insufficiency of Reuben's recommendation, Reuben's offer. It is a redemption story. It is an attempt to redeem Simeon out of the hand of this Egyptian foreigner as they see him currently. But it is insufficient. What is Jacob doing? What is Reuben doing? What is Jacob doing? We turn next to Jacob and his response to the events that occurred to his sons in Egypt. He makes two statements at the end of this story. He comments on his sons' deeds and his sons' death. Their father's words are those of Jacob and not Israel. They are words of the supplanter humanist rather than the words of the one who wrestled with God. Verse 36, Jacob said unto them, "Me ye have bereaved of my children, Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me." Oddly enough, Jacob speaks better than he knows. He says, "You have bereaved me, you have robbed me of my children. You have robbed me of Joseph, you have robbed me of Simeon." Now, we don't know how much Jacob probably knows about the activity of the brothers, but he speaks the truth. Those brothers had robbed him of Joseph. We know that from the story. And in consequence to them robbing him of Joseph, they have also orchestrated an environment in which Simeon is also taken from him. He is right. They are guilty of robbing them of these two brothers. Now the brothers want to take Benjamin away. And he's looking at us like, every time you guys leave, someone doesn't come back. We can't do this anymore. But at the end of his statement, Jacob shows his absolute materialism and faithlessness. All these things are against me. Everything is going wrong. All of these things are conspiring to make my life miserable. But we know that nothing could be further from the truth. The audience knows that this helpless cry comes only from a total ignorance of the facts. Jacob's inability to see or to trust his God. After Reuben's offer, Jacob refuses to listen to his son's plan for the redemption of Simeon. He says in verse 38, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which ye go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave." You have to ask yourself a question here. Does Jacob even know that he has more sons than Benjamin? It sounds like from this verse, Jacob only has two sons, one of which is dead, and Benjamin is left alone. Dude, he's got 10 brothers. Well, if you count Simeon dead, he's got 9 brothers. The favoritism of Jacob has not diminished over the years. If anything, it seems to have gotten worse. Benjamin seems to have more favor than Joseph. He won't allow Benjamin to leave his side, even if it means the perpetual imprisonment of Simeon. Remember, there's another brother at issue here. Simeon is still in Egypt. But in Jacob's mind, he might as well be dead. Jacob fears the potential hazard of Benjamin traveling to Egypt. Should anything happen to Benjamin, Jacob anticipates almost immediate death from sorrow. If anything happened to Benjamin, if he was just walking along, pricked his finger, got sepsis, and died of blood poisoning, you'd bring my hair down, you'd bring me down to the grave. You'd bring me to death in sorrow. It is not so easy to break one's heart. Jacob demonstrates the problem with humanistic and materialistic thinking. Everything is against me. It's an old adage, but it is not paranoid to think the world is out to get you when it comes from a humanistic and materialistic view. If there is nothing out there but molecules in motion, then there is no reason for hope. Christianity alone gives man hope. Christianity tells us that there is a God who is concerned about the welfare of his people. And Christianity tells us what God has done to intervene in the horrible mess that sin has made to bring us life. This does not deny the reality of sorrow. Rather, it gives sorrow reality. Why would you be sad over molecules in motion? We sorrow over the evil of sin. Death represents the violence of sin against the created order. And yet Christianity gives us hope for one day death will die. Christianity gives us hope not merely in the life to come, but now. Providence still works. Jacob couldn't see it. Jacob said, all these things are against him, when we know that that absolutely is not the truth. All of these things that were happening to Jacob were happening in order to bring him and redeem him and rescue him. Providence still works. We cannot see the hand of God moving in the world at times, but never, let us never doubt its presence or its motion. God never robs his people. God never bereaves his people. He prunes. He does everything that happens out of love to make us more like Christ. Everything isn't against you in this world if you are in Christ. In fact, if you are in Christ, everything is for you. You want Bible on that? Romans chapter 8. If God be for us, who can be against us? What is Reuben doing? What is Jacob doing? But finally, what is Joseph doing? This is the big question, if you will, in the whole story. The main character that we must understand is Joseph. And the commentators make a lot of presumptions, assumptions about the motivation behind Joseph's behavior. But if you remember my comments previously about this, all the way back when we first started looking at Joseph, you probably know already what I think his motivation is. In contrast to Joseph's behavior, as he is mean to their faces, he puts their money back in their sacks. This kind of duality within Joseph. He loves them, he hates them, he loves them, he hates them. It kind of gets your mind spinning. This causes the most controversy for the commentators. Look at verse 7. And they said, the man, in verse 7, Joseph saw his brethren and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them, and he said unto them, ye are spies. To see the nakedness of the land are ye come. Why does Joseph treat his brothers badly? Why does he accuse them of being spies? Before we get lost in that question, let me make a moral judgment about Joseph's behavior first. He sins. He breaks the ninth commandment. He is lying. He is making believe. He is deceiving them into thinking that he thinks that they are spies when he knows that they're not spies. He knows who they are, and yet he calls them spies. Anything that he is doing for the good does not excuse his deception. The Bible does not excuse this. It is merely recounting what is happening to demonstrate the way that God in his providence is using even the sinful men for his glory and for his purposes. But even saying that, what is impelling this? What is the motivation for this? Is he mistreating them out of vengeance? Is he saying, these guys were just jerks to me, and so now I have the power, I'm really going to make them pay. Pay and pay and pay. The facts don't allow this. Look at verse 24. And he turned himself about from them and wept. Doesn't work. A man out for revenge, when he sees contrition in the objects of his vengeance, does not turn around and weep. Joseph loves his brothers. He's not seeking to revenge himself upon them. He's doing something else. Is he doing all this for the benefit of Benjamin? Is he trying to protect Benjamin? And this is a alternative that some have argued, that he's doing all this to make sure Benjamin's going to be safe. He wants Benjamin to come here so he can take care of him. It's a viable theory, but I don't think that the context allows you to come to that conclusion. Benjamin's not even there. And he knows what Benjamin does and who he is. And Benjamin right now is quite safe, alone at home with Dad. That's who it's all about. It's all about Joseph's concern about his brother's relationship to Dad. But more on that later. He is trying to see if his brothers have changed. Why? To Joseph? No. To Benjamin? No. To Dad. Has their relationship to Dad changed? And he does so in an interesting way. Notice his behavior in verse 16. Send one of you and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved. Look at verse 19. And if ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison, and go ye and carry corn and family to to your houses. Joseph, by both of these alternatives, is separating one brother from the rest and putting him in prison or putting him free. There is a little bit of mere parallelism here. As he was separated from his brethren, so he is separating one from them. Why? Is this an attempt at vengeance? No, he wants to see the way his brothers relate to one another. He wants to see the way that they are operating as a family. Now remember, he puts them in the ward. He puts them in the prison house, and he's the second in Egypt. He's Pharaoh's right-hand man. So let me ask you, what prison house do you think he put him in as the second in command, as Pharaoh's right-hand man, as the grand vizier, the governor of Egypt, the lord of the land? Could it be that he put him in the prison house of Pharaoh, the prison house that he himself had occupied years before? There are shadows here of Joseph's own experience. Will the brothers rescue Simeon? Will the brothers protect Benjamin? Reuben is willing to sacrifice his two sons to rescue Simeon. What will they do for Benjamin, their father's favorite? Notice in that statement, when they come before him, in verse 9, and Joseph remembered the dreams that he dreamed of them and said unto them, ye are spies. His activity toward them is incited by his remembering the dreams. And there were two. One dream was of his brethren out gathering sheaves. And his sheave, they all suddenly were anthropomorphic. The sheaves start acting like human beings. His sheaf stands in the middle and everyone else's sheaf bows before it. His brothers bowing before him. That dream now is fulfilled. His brothers have come for grain, represented by the sheaves, and have bowed themselves to the earth before Joseph. But there's another dream that has yet to be fulfilled. The moon, the sun, and the 11 stars are to bow before Joseph. That dream, Joseph probably knows, is yet to remain because his father, his mother, his brother Benjamin, has yet to bow before him. That dream represents the restoration of the family, that the family is going to be made whole again. But what may be going through Joseph's mind is, what kind of family is it going to be? Is it going to be a family like it was before, a family rent apart by favoritism and jealousy? Or a family repaired? A family that is brought into fullness and wholeness and not division. The positive perspective of Joseph comes in the way and the care he shows of his brother. In verse 25, we read that Joseph commands the people who are selling grain to put their money, his brother's money, back into their bags. Joseph is not going to take a penny from his brothers. This defeats any notion that he's seeking revenge. He's doing good to them. He has understood that he's been made fruitful in this land. He understands now that this is the way that God is going to bring his family and rescue his family from this famine, to bring them all to Egypt. He won't allow them to suffer because of it. He understands that it is his responsibility to take care of his family. But the brothers don't know this. They have trouble interpreting the schizophrenic quality of Joseph's actions. He's good, he's bad, he's good, he's bad. We don't get it. And finally they ask an interesting question. They finally begin to take God into their calculations, as they say in verse 28, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack, and their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God hath done to us? What is God doing to us? This question echoes down the corridor of time through the rest of the Old Testament. Israel asks this in Egypt. Moses asks this in the wilderness. Israel asks this at the Red Sea and in the wilderness journeying. They ask it in Canaan. They ask it in oppression. David asks it fleeing Saul and fleeing Jerusalem. Israel and Judah ask it when the civil war of the divided kingdom. They ask it in exile. They ask it returned from exile. They ask it under the Roman thumb. The disciples ask it of Jesus, and the church asks it even today. What is God doing to us? What has God done for you? Let me tell you what you may not know. Like Joseph's brothers, you have done evil and deserve God's judgment. Your sin deserves God's wrath, for you have defied Him. When you did not want Him, though, He loved you. And He acted to save you from death, the justice your sin deserved. He did this by Jesus, by placing your death upon Him. He put Him to death for your sins, and He offers you in exchange Jesus' righteousness. Now that salvation is offered to you, what will you do with it? Like free money, your life is granted to you without cost. Why do you turn away? Will you obtain something better without God? Certainly not. Every good and every perfect gift comes only from Him. Whatever it may cost to follow Christ, it does not even come close to what you gain. Would you hold on to one penny when you could exchange it for infinite wealth? Will you give up your poverty in order to obtain Jesus' riches? Christian, what is God doing to you? What is God doing to you? I don't know what you may be experiencing in life. There are many things that we experience in life that make life hard, that make life difficult, and may cause you to ask the question, what is God doing to me? But the answer is good. That's the answer, and there is no other. That is the truth, the absolute correspondence between thought and reality. We may have trouble believing it, but it is the case. God only does that which is good for His people. We may not be able to understand in the midst of our struggle, in the midst of our suffering, how it is that this brings about good. But it is the truth. We may be like the brothers, disbelieving the money in the sack, unable to accept the gift horse without examining its teeth. When life is good, are we waiting for the other shoe to drop? Just wait. Is that our response to blessing? Or we may be like Jacob in perpetual sorrow, looking forward to the blessed relief is death. Life's hard, and then you die. We often rival the harshest pessimist in our view of God. How faithless, how unbelieving when God has said through Paul, what shall we say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? Y'all have heard me enough to know that that's one of my favorite verses. The absolute astounding logic of that statement. If God sacrificed the greatest and the best in His Son to bring you salvation, why do you think He's going to quibble about the little things? Doing good to you today, this week, this year, this month, the rest of your life is so small in comparison to what He has already done good for you in Christ. The words of Jesus ring through the centuries to us today. Don't be faithless, but believing.